Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, tomorrow marks the 25th anniversary of that statewide vote to end rent control in Massachusetts. We hear from two people who led the drive against it in 1994.
You know, rent control in itself is a failed housing policy, but it's also very lazy because it's easy to say and it sounds really good, but it doesn't build one unit of housing.
And those who want to bring rent control back today.
We don't have to go back to the same exact system that we had 25 years ago. But I think everyone has an interest in, you know, ensuring that people have a place to live.
Also, jazz legend Wynton Marsalis.
Jazz teaches you to respect how much other people know, how creative another person is, whether you agree with them or not. Because we can come around the common goal of swinging.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. 25 years after the state voted to repeal rent control, it's back on the agenda on Beacon Hill with a bill before the House that would allow cities and towns to bring it back. We'll hear from the bill's sponsor and a community activist supporting it in a little bit. But first, we want to get the history. Rent control was abolished by a slim margin, 51% to 49%. It was a contentious fight. We spoke to two of the leaders who led the drive against it. John Maddox, a Cambridge condo owner and lawyer, who wrote the 1994 ballot question, and Denise Gilson, who in 1994 was the chair of the Massachusetts Homeowners Coalition, the political organization that sponsored the ballot question. John told us how he first got involved with the issue.
For me, I was an owner-occupier of a condo that was supposed to be rented out under rent control. And at some point, the rent board started cracking down on condos that were in that situation that had missed a deadline for condo conversion to get out of rent control. There were several hundred, at least, units that had missed the deadline from the condo conversion, but they'd never cracked down and enforced this rule against owner occupancy.
Meaning that if you bought the unit while it was rent controlled and you weren't living in it, you couldn't then convert it to be something you could live in. It had to remain as a rent-controlled unit.
That's right.
For
we
renting.
Had to rent it out to a third party. So, for example, I had a $700 mortgage when I was living at it in this unit. If I had to rent it out to somebody else, I would have gotten like $130 in rent. So if the crackdown really affected people like me, there were 24 units in my building. Almost all of us were owner-occupiers, so we were all so-called condo criminals. We could have been, theoretically, we could have been evicted. I don't think anybody ever was. And we could have been subject to I think it was a $100 a day fine. I don't think anybody ever actually received a fine. But they started the process, and that's what concerned me. That's why I went to Denise's meeting to see what this landlord group was doing to try to fight against rent control.
You proposed a statewide ballot initiative as a way to go at this, but there had been legal challenges to rent control in the past. What kind of challenges had there been, and why didn't those work?
Well, they tried at the local level to make reforms to rent control in Cambridge. The problem there is that two-thirds of the residents of Cambridge are tenants, so necessarily there was an absolute majority against reforming rent control at the local level. So to me, a statewide ballot, a statewide rule was the way to go. The problem with that is that to get it on the ballot, I had to have something that had statewide application, and rent control existed in only three cities or towns, Boston, Cambridge, and Brookline. So I initially submitted a ballot question to the Attorney General's office, and they said, you can't have this on a statewide ballot. It only applies to three places. It only affects three places.
So you had to write something that would essentially qualify in every city and town.
Yes. And I was thinking, how can I possibly do this? And it occurred to me, add an exception that affects every single town, and not just the three, and then you can get on the statewide ballot. So I put in an exception that had a very limited form of rent control that would only affect apartments up to a certain dollar value, and the city or town would have to reimburse the landlord for the difference.
So I just want to make sure that I understand this. Essentially what you did was, rather than focusing on the rent control in three cities and towns, you created a ballot that created policies for rent control in every city and town in the Commonwealth, but in such a way that it would essentially be unattractive to then implement rent control.
That's correct.
Under those conditions.
Nobody in the right mind would go for the exception.
So, Denise, I want to bring you into this. Why were you initiating and getting so active in repealing rent control?
My husband and I purchased a rent-controlled property in North Cambridge, 4 units. We lived in one. We rented 3. And we understood when we bought it that it was rent-controlled. What we didn't understand is what that really meant. And after, you know, a very short period of time, I realized we were in so far over our head just in terms of being able to properly care for our property and plan for our future.
I think I need you to explain that. That's in detail or
sure.
with some
so,
examples.
So, you know, the government, you know, the city of Cambridge sets the rent amount. And more importantly, it was an 1865 house that needed a lot of work. And it's not an easy thing for a rent-controlled property owner to go to the city or town and say, we need a new roof, or we need to have a new heating system, because everything has to be qualified.
What does that mean?
It means that you have to show them, you know, the records that you have, what the repair is, why you need it, how much it's going to cost. If they approve it, then they give a life to that cost. So the rent might increase for, if they say, you know, it's a water heater and they're going to, you know, give it 6 years. And after 6 years, your rent is increased. And then after 6 years, it goes back down again. It's convoluted.
Denise, there must have been critics at the time who said, we understand your capital repairs argument, but you also have 3 rental units. And if rent control goes away, you're just going to make a lot more money on the rents in those rental units. Did that figure into your calculus?
That's an argument that you always hear. And, you know, the reason, and there are so many reasons why this system is just a failed housing policy. You know, what we were able to expose during the Question 9 campaign were the shortcomings of rent control, which included the deterioration of the housing stock, the disproportionate amount of state aid that went to other cities and towns, the overregulation of private property, the creation of a divisive community, an acrimonious political climate. It just went on and on and on. It was a failed housing policy.
So I want to stay with that for a minute.
Sure.
Because John had said to us a minute ago that there wasn't support within the communities like Cambridge. There wasn't support because so many people were tenants in Cambridge. So if it was a failed policy, why was it hard to get support to change the policy in the communities where it existed?
Because 2/3 of the people were benefiting from it. So people think of it sometimes as a social justice issue, but it's really an economic issue. So me as a property owner, even though I only have 3 units and the rent is set by the city, if you, as a single mom with 3 children, come to me and say, you want to rent my apartment, and John Maddox here, an attorney who is, you know, living alone, even though the rent is set, as a prudent property owner with a mortgage to pay at the end of the month, who am I going to rent to? I'm going to rent to John Maddox every single time. So when we did a demographic survey in 1992 of who was actually living in rent-controlled properties in Cambridge, over 90% of the people residing were white, college-educated, in their prime earning years, age 25 to 40, single and living alone, because it was an economic issue and not a social justice issue.
So part of the argument at the time as you were preparing this ballot initiative then was those who people perceive are benefiting from rent control are not those who are actually benefiting from rent control. Is that what you're
exactly,
saying?
Exactly.
Where would you say was the tipping point when you thought question 9 is going to pass? The state is going to repeal rent control. Did you know for a while? Was it like you're biting your fingernails the election night?
Well, John didn't believe it at all.
And I never thought it would pass, John.
I thought we would get a few signatures. People would realize this is the way to do it. And then maybe like 2 years later, we would really go all out.
You thought you were ahead of your time
but
at that
Denise
moment.
Was way ahead of me on this one.
All right.
So.
Yeah.
I believed it from the very beginning.
How come?
Sheer will and determination. We had tried everything else, and there was such a small group of grassroots people, you know, moms and pops, people like myself who were working full-time. I had two small children, and it was just so onerous, and we were determined, and I just felt from the very beginning that this was a possibility.
What did you say to those who argued? Because people did at the time. I moved to Cambridge in 1994. I remember this all unfolding.
Mm.
What was your answer to people who said, this, you know, people in Western Massachusetts should not be deciding the question of rent control in Cambridge or Brookline or Boston?
That was a pretty easy argument. I traveled across the state visiting, you know, small property owners, and I would meet at, you know, KFC halls and American Legions and all that sort of thing. And when you speak to people in Worcester and, you know, Springfield and places like Fall River or Lynn or, you know, out in the Berkshires, and they understand that the proportion of state aid that their city or town was receiving was actually less because Cambridge was getting more state aid for this, you know, program that...
Explain how that works.
So it's just a percentage number that, you know, cities and towns get state aid, and Cambridge was getting a disproportionate amount of state aid that could have been going to other cities and towns.
What did rent control have to do with that?
Because we were artificially depressing our property values. So when people began to understand that... And then there was this, you know, the fundamental unfairness of it all, that somehow on the backs of small property owners, people like myself and my husband, who, you know, bought this for family, we had two kids, we're both working, we're trying to save money to put our kids through college at the, you know, they were little at the time, but that was the goal. And somehow I was supporting, you know, the people that were living in our units in a way, but you know, the people next door that had a two-family home that was home, you know, owner-occupied, they were not subject to the same rules and regulations. So there was this fundamental unfairness to it all that was the driving factor.
So we're in a very different housing market today. And I know that you know that critics of your efforts at that time argued that without rent control, tenants would be priced out of their apartments in the face of rising rent. It happened, according to the National Bureau of Economic Research, quote, immediately following rent control, rents at formerly controlled units in Cambridge increased steeply. Simultaneously, residential turnover rose sharply, with the sharpest increase occurring at decontrolled units as tenants relocated in the face of rising rents, end of quote. We're in a very different picture today. I think I'll ask both of you, John first and then Denise. Is there a form of rent control that you think could or would be necessary for housing justice for the single mom with three kids that Denise brought up in some of our most high rent markets in the Commonwealth now?
Well, I think the answer to that is, first of all, I believe in the fairness of market economics in distributing housing fairly. But the way to help lower income people with housing is to create more housing. It's a supply and demand thing. There's downward pressure on increasing the supply, even though there's a great demand for housing in the Boston area. So I'm not an economist or anything, but I mean it's basic supply and demand. You need to increase the number of units in the Boston area to keep prices within range for low-income people. Otherwise, you have to move farther out. So what happens? I think some of the people you're talking about moved from Cambridge to Somerville. They then moved to like places like Framingham, a little farther out where rents were a little lower, or they could buy. A lot of tenants, they're not tenants their whole lives. They're people who start out as tenants. They save some money. They buy a condo or a single, and they would like to stay nearer to Boston, but then they moved to a place like Framingham.
So what you're saying, I think, if I understand you correctly, is that that rent is the wrong lever, that things like zoning, density, construction,
yes,
et cetera, is the lever one would.
That's right.
Would you say, John, would you say that the greater Boston region is in need of some changes in things like zoning in order to allow? I mean, right now, the market is responding to market conditions and building a lot of high-income luxury units. We don't see a lot of development of triple-deckers anymore. So would you say that you think there might be a need for some action in those areas?
I'm not an economist. I don't know how to solve housing as the big picture. But I just know that if you have more units, it's going to help everybody up and down the economic ladder.
It's really about, let's look at the Boston region. I mean, we need more workforce housing. And I'm loath to call it affordable housing because, you know, some people can afford, and very often do, a $6,000 a month rent on Harrison Avenue in downtown Boston. We know that to be a fact, right? The rents are extraordinary. So, yeah, what we have to do is look at, you know, building additional housing. We have to look at inclusionary zoning. You know, in Cambridge, we have the Affordable Housing Trust. We have the Community Preservation Act. And, in fact, right now, out of the 52,000 housing units in Cambridge, 8,100 of them are considered, you know, affordable or workforce housing, which is 15%. So I think what we have to look at is transportation. We have to look at, you know, the infrastructure around. We have a lot of jobs. People need to be able to get to those jobs. But we also have to take into account, it's really interesting, there's a segment of the community that does not want to build horizontal because they don't want to take down any trees. There's another segment of the community that doesn't want to build vertical because they don't want shadows being cast on their neighborhoods. So I think as a region and as a community, we have to determine how many housing units we want in our community that are dedicated to affordable. And then we have to figure out how to build them. You know, rent control in itself is a failed housing policy, but it's also very lazy because it's easy to say and it sounds really good, but it doesn't build one unit of housing.
That was Denise Gilson, executive director of the Harvard Square Business Association, and in 1994, the chair of the Massachusetts Homeowners Coalition. We also heard from John Maddox, lawyer and the author of the 1994 ballot question on rent control. Stay with us. Coming up, we'll hear from two folks trying to bring back rent control. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Before the break, we heard from two of the driving forces behind the 1994 ballot question that ultimately abolished rent control in Massachusetts. Tomorrow marks the 25th anniversary of that statewide vote. So why 25 years later are we talking about possibly bringing rent control back? To answer that, I'm joined here in Studio 3 by Massachusetts State Representative Michael Conley. He's the co-sponsor of an act enabling local options for tenant protections, a bill that would allow local cities and towns to regulate rent prices. Representative Conley, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, thank you for having me today, and thanks for covering the topic.
Absolutely. Also joining us on the line is Lisa Owens, Executive Director of City Life Vita Urbana. Lisa, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you so much.
So, Representative Conley, I want to start by asking you, why have you decided to try to bring back rent control 25 years after Massachusetts voters essentially decided to get rid of it?
Well, the answer is we're facing a housing emergency, and that emergency can be seen with the homelessness crisis on our streets. That can be seen in continued displacement of working-class residents, of people of color and families, and it can be seen in the extreme rent burden that renters are facing in Boston, Cambridge, and Somerville, and really in communities all around the Commonwealth.
And what exactly does the bill propose?
What the bill would do would be repeal the statewide ban on rent control, and then it would enable municipalities to bring everyone to the table. And I think for me that means bringing owners and renters alike to the table to craft solutions to stop displacement. And that could mean rent stabilization. That could mean stronger condo conversion protections. That could also mean just cause eviction protections to help provide stability for renters and to help give people a chance to stay in the communities and to stay in their homes.
Would you say that the bill is more targeted than the rent control as it existed previous to 1994?
I would say it's flexible. You know, it's a local option, and it really empowers city officials to bring everyone to the table and to try to craft solutions. So I certainly do not think we need to relitigate or argue over the way rent control looked in the 1980s and the 1990s. But what I do think is that this legislation is in keeping with a trend that we're seeing around the country. We've seen just this year states like Oregon, California, and New York State pass comprehensive tenant protection bills and rent stabilization bills. And I think this would give our city officials a chance to really consider what might work on the local level.
Lisa, why is this bill important to you as a community activist?
Well, you know, as an organization that works for and with low-income and working-class tenants and homeowners, you know, we really see that the problem is giant real estate corporations who have been in control of our housing market for the past 25 years. And we see the results of that. We see every week we see families like the one that came into our door a couple of months ago, a grandmother who had been in her apartment for 30 years who received a $700 rent increase. And she came to us distraught, wondering what she was going to do, how she was going to afford that. You know, that really is what happens when we allow the housing market to be controlled by really just unchecked greed.
So I would ask you, Lisa, so mm-hmm. you heard the segment before.
Yeah.
The person who spearheaded the rent control rollback in 1994, Denise Gilson, was not a large corporate owner. She was a small property owner of a four-unit building. Did that sound like unchecked greed to you, what you were hearing from the people who were proposing rolling back rent control back in 94?
So what I can speak to now are our current conditions. And in our current conditions, what we see increasingly are these giant real estate corporations that are buying up buildings that were once owned by people who were just regular mom-and-pop folks who were just trying to make a living. But now what we see really is our housing market being controlled by a very few and very large real estate interests. And really, that's what we're fighting against. And we really are excited about Mike's bill because it gives cities and towns the option to take the power back from these giant real estate corporations and decide for ourselves what's the menu of options that we're going to need to respond to local conditions, to respond to the housing crisis that affects all of us across the state.
Representative Conley, would the bill as you have it proposed protect small property owners who are not, as Lisa's talking about it, the sort of the target of what you're trying to do here?
Absolutely. So the legislation we filed, and I should mention I co-lead filed it with Representative Nika Elgardo of Jamaica Plain, and we've worked closely with Lisa and City Life and other advocates. And one of the key features of our bill is it completely exempts owner-occupied triple-deckers or duplexes. We certainly weren't thinking about entangling your true small property owner. And it further empowers a municipality to craft additional exemptions that might make sense in a particular city or town. So really the focus is more for those corporate landlords, those absentee landlords, people who are really engaging in a significant business activity. In this time, I should add, because I think a lot's changed since 1994, in this time of profound wealth and income inequality, with an economy that really hasn't been working for working people, and of course in a real estate market where we have seen real estate values go through the roof, and as Lisa alludes to, international real estate speculation really begin to distort our housing market and make it virtually impossible for working people to try to raise a family in some of our communities.
So the housing stock in the Commonwealth is not the newest housing stock in the country. And in fact, a lot of our housing stock is quite old. Lisa, one of the arguments that Denise Gilson had made before the break was the argument that if you suppress rents, you suppress capital improvements and property safety and quality from the homeowners. Do you have any concern that the communities and the people you represent might sort of suffer from that negative externality of lack of investment and lack of quality and upkeep if the property's rents are suppressed?
Yeah, we don't, because as you heard from Mike, this bill really gives cities and towns the options to craft solutions that make sense for their particular localities. And so what that means is we have the flexibility to learn from places like New York, which has really learned a lot over the years about how to craft and strengthen existing policies to make sure that, for example, major capital improvements happen, but not at the detriment to the working class families that they're intended to support.
I guess I'm wondering, and I'm really wondering this. It does seem like if revenues are down, investment is down, is it possible, and Lisa, you can either continue with your answer or Representative Conley, whoever wants to, is it really possible to strike that balance so that rents aren't going up too much? I know, for example, in the law passed in Oregon, it's 7% plus a premium every year. And also make sure that property upkeep happens responsibly and in an equality way.
We believe that it is entirely possible. So I'll remind our audience that it was policy that got us into this mess. So even looking beyond rent control, if you look at the impacts of redlining, for example, in our communities, which caused a lot of the poor building conditions that you see in communities of color in Boston, it was really the impact of racist policies that kept capital away from people of color. And now really it's going to be policy that gets us out of this. And so it's going to be a comprehensive package of policies, including but not exclusively rent control, right? And each city and town has its own unique local conditions, which is why we need the flexibility, I think, of this local options bill.
Representative Conley, you've said a couple of times in this discussion you've talked about the importance of bringing everybody to the table. Do you have landlords, property owners who have been at the table, have been helping design this legislation, or are on board and in support of it?
You know, we've received a range of responses. We've heard from some folks associated with a group, Mass Landlords, that, you know, they could see some potential compromise or solution. Of course, we're in the early stages. Rep. Elgardo and I spent the better part of the spring drafting the legislation. And really, the next big step will be a committee hearing before the Joint Committee on Housing. So I think that'll be the next opportunity to really hear feedback and then consider how we can move forward. And if I could just add, picking up on what Lisa said, you know, I view, and I think many of us view this concept of rent control or tenant protections as really just one component of a much larger vision. And so for me, that vision is guaranteed housing for all, treating housing as a human right. And, you know, to pick up on a word that Lisa used, comprehensive really has to be the way that we go. And that means, you know, smart regional production of housing around the region. That means strong tenant protections. That means raising new revenue in a progressive way to make big public investments to ensure that the housing we're building actually serves the people who needs it most. And above all, you know, another key thing that this word doesn't get addressed enough is homelessness. We've seen family homelessness double in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts over the past 10 years. And you think about these past 10 years, it's been, you know, steady economic growth. This should be the best of the best. And yet we see things like homelessness skyrocketing. So I do want to be clear. I think rent control is just a component of a much more comprehensive approach. So to ensuring housing.
The thing that's on my mind as I'm listening to the two of you is you really are talking about a very flexible piece of legislation with lots of room for win-win, lots of flexibility. If it were that easy, wouldn't we have done it already? Isn't it reasonable to be a little skeptical that it could be that win-win and here we are in 2019 and that's not the way it is everywhere or the way it's been in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts for 30 years? Do you understand where that skepticism would come from?
You know what? I'd like to address that. You know, so I want to say that now is our moment. We have never been at this crisis point in our state, and certainly not in Boston. We also, though, have never seen such a widespread cry out for bold new policy solutions. And we're not just talking about housing. This is a moment in our nation right now, and Massachusetts is poised to be the next state to ride the wave of bold tenant and housing protection for everybody. Get a housing, think about housing that people, everyday people can afford. Think about not having to make the hard decision between elder care and paying your rent. Right? This is what's at stake for us, and we are building a statewide Homes for All movement. I really encourage people who are excited by this vision, excited by the opportunity to build a campaign that really builds toward what Mike is talking about, this big, bold housing guarantee for everybody, which starts with but doesn't conclude with housing with rent control. So I want to just let folks know, if you're interested in joining the movement, to go to reclaimboston.org and sign the pledge and join the movement.
And Representative Conley, in the last 30 seconds or so, is there anything unique to the Commonwealth of Massachusetts that makes this particularly doable or not doable?
Well, you know, I think we've always been a leader. Truth be told, we wouldn't actually be leading. We would be following several other states, notably, again, Oregon, California, and New York. And I think, there was a ballot question. There were concerns over that process. But I think it has now been 25 years. And so now is a perfectly good time for us to revisit the issue. So I'm glad we're having the conversation.
Massachusetts State Representative Michael Conley, co-sponsor of an act enabling local options for tenant protections, a bill that would allow towns and cities to establish rent control. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And Lisa Owens, Executive Director of City Life Vita Urbana. Lisa, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more coming up. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Renowned jazz artist Wynton Marsalis. His prolific career has resulted in a wide breadth of music. Everything from big band swing to jazzed-up versions of nursery rhymes made just for kids. This weekend, the Wynton Marsalis Quintet comes to the Boston Symphony Hall. Ahead of their performance, we checked in with Wynton Marsalis, who's also the managing and artistic director for jazz at Lincoln Center and the leader of its orchestra. We began by asking him how he's grown as a musician since he first came to Boston at age 17.
When I first came, I was 17. I had no sense, really, of first the breadth and depth of jazz, let alone symphonic music and the different experiences that I had, the students I met there. And to be a part of the tradition of Tanglewood and the Boston Symphony, and it was a great trumpet tradition with Armando Gitala and Roger Voisin, and to meet other great musicians in the Boston Symphony. And at that time, Gunther Schuller was conducting and running the Berkshire Music Center. He became a mentor of mine. I learned all kinds of things from him. I played under Bernstein there. We played Prokofiev Fifth. I met trumpet players and colleagues that I have to this day. Just, it was such a new world. And Tanglewood was a place of such quality and so many great musicians. And it's a great tradition that goes all the way back to Koussevitzky and Bartok and the music he wrote and the conducting workshops. I could go on and on and on. And the impact that it had on me as a musician and a student, understanding what serious musicianship was about. And not that I didn't know that, because my father's a musician and somebody who is a teacher and studied and played and believed in practicing and all those things. So I grew up around serious musicians. But to see a lot of younger musicians really serious about playing and to meet that range of people was a defining point in my life.
Let's forward now in your career. You've been incredibly prolific, a wide range of recordings. You've done classical compositions. There was a stretch where you produced, in 1999, something like 10 records in a single year. And then there was a stretch around 2010 for a while where you didn't record a lot. What accounts for the kinds of ebbs and flows for you of that? I don't want to say productivity, because I suspect that you were plenty productive. You just weren't recording as much during that time.
Well, I've always been recording, so we just haven't put records out. So all through 2010, 11, 12, we're making recordings the whole time. As a matter of fact, now we're in the process of releasing 100 records in 5 years.
So, oh, my gosh.
We've released six already this year. And I think we released Betty Carter, Buddy Bolden, a piece called Swing Symphony that we did with the St. Louis Symphony Jazz and Art of our large orchestra with arrangements we did inspired by great artists, American artists. Jazz for Kids, which we just put out here as nursery rhymes and songs with new, fresh arrangements, different kind of look at music we all know. Everything from Itsy Bitsy Spider. To The Wheels on the Bus Go Round and Round. We have a Christmas album coming out called Big Band Holidays 2, because we had another very successful Christmas album. And at the top of this year, we're going to release a piece by Sherman Irby, Inferno, Wayne Shorter, a great album we did with him. Then in February, we're going to release Duke Ellington's Black, Brown, and Beige, and a new piece that I wrote called The Ever Funky Lowdown. And it's going to go on and on. So for the next 5 years, we're going to be nothing but absolute productivity the entire time.
And what made you decide to do it that way, record for a long time and then release for a long time?
Well, I just go with what the opportunities are and what is, the recordings are less commercial products for me than they are statements of our art and where it is. Not just me, all of us now end up dealing with our orchestra, Jazzy Lincoln Center Orchestra. We work on a lot of music together. We have 10 arrangers, so we produce a lot of music in a very short time. And some years we've done 8, 9 original shows of music that never existed. So
incredible.
If you put the fact that we've been working together basically 20-something years, you have a sense of how much music we actually have and new music. So, and I was also waiting just for the time that I felt the culture needed for us to be very definitive. And I think that this is a point, it's time for us to be extremely definitive.
What do you mean by the culture needs you to be very definitive?
We all have an umbilical cord that we're attached to. And it's very easy for you to get so caught up in your own magnificence that you lose sight of that cord. People who are in my age, it's interesting age for us because that's when your parents start to pass away and, you start to experience things you really didn't think of. And you start to question things, fundamental things like what is home? If your mother passes away, your father passes away, it's something you may have taken for granted that was central to who you are as a person. When you get into the age when that begins to happen, or you start to have grandchildren, or you start to consider very fundamental things in a very primal and active way. So a culture has to do that also. Nations have to do that. And we are certainly at that point in our country where we've lost sight of who we are.
You have been critical in the recent past about current African-American music, some pieces of hip-hop and rap. And earlier, you mentioned to me the importance of this cultural moment and of the definitiveness that you want from at least your music, if not jazz, in this moment. Can you talk a little more about that?
As a citizen, I'm critical of many things in our culture, and I always feel free to express it. I have said it from the beginning. Words like all these things that are commonplace, I'm categorically against that. I don't like it. I never liked it. And I'm from the hood, so I don't need a credential from somebody born in 1985. I will continue to say it. Not just about that. That does not also mean that I support other things that are against people just because they're black, or that I'm blind to American racism or any of the things that plague us. The simplistic view of the world that robs citizens of their right to make nuanced and considered points of view is also a thing that I'm critical of. And when I'm speaking, I'm not trying to speak from any perspective of looking to garner favor with any group of people. I try to speak from my experience, and I try to be honest about my feelings. And I maintain the ideas that I've expressed about the use of these type of pejorative terms, or the buffoonery of reducing black people to being fools. I'm not for that.
Does the practice of jazz and the presence of jazz offer an opportunity to reunite, to bring people back together in collaboration and improvisation at a time when we need it?
It does, but it's an earned collaboration. You understand that a part of your critique is also yourself. So if I'm critiquing something in our culture, I have to also critique myself. And when you collaborate with other people, other people's expertise and knowledge helps you also to define yourself. And it's important when jazz teaches you to respect how much other people know, how creative another person is, whether you agree with them or not. Because we can come around the common goal of swinging. The things we want to do are subsumed by our search for common ground. And that common, if that common ground is serious, hey, you could come up with something. But as Jelly Roll Martin, the great first composing intellectual of jazz, observed when he was in the Tenderloin District of New Orleans, you saw all kind of people there because it didn't really take a credential to be down at the bottom. So people can come together to go up high, or they can go down low and find each other too.
Let's listen specifically to a piece of music. This is Blue Twirl off of Jazz and Art. Us through the definitive in this piece. What is the statement you're making or the cultural moment you're capturing in a piece like this?
First, that's a piece composed by Vincent Gardner, great trombonist in the Jazz Lincoln Center Orchestra, also is the artistic director of Jazz Houston, a nonprofit organization that supports jazz education and performance in Houston. That piece was inspired by Sam Gilliam's artwork. And it uses a progression of a standard song, but it has many time shifts, and we use elements of like Sam's way of putting paint on the canvas, and some sections are really abstract with us making different type of sounds and a low bass cue, and then we go into a progression and a swing, and Vince's music is always very layered. He always uses a lot of pyramids and kind of interlocking parts that sometimes are 30-second notes apart. So it's like, it'd be like eight horns playing that one line. And his music is arranging is very colorful. Probably the greatest arrangement any of us have played is Vincent's arrangement of Thelonious Monk's Light Blue. And that's one that we play for years. And whenever we hear it, we always say, man, we don't know how he heard that one. We just put out on Jazz for Kids, Vince has a recording of Rubber Ducky. That's one of the hardest damn arrangements to play. Boy, I must have practiced my part, just the layering of the parts, because the melody of Rubber Ducky is in a pep section a la Duke Ellington. I think if Duke heard it, he'd say, damn, is that how he heard? And he has all kind of underlying contrapuntal lines. And you play the original Rubber Ducky, you'll see what Vincent Gardner does with his arrangements.
I love it that you have enough respect for what music can bring to children that you're going to put that kind of layering and challenge into Rubber Ducky.
I did an alphabet book for children called Jazz ABCs, and it had the biggest words in the world in it. And it goes through the ABCs, and it uses a different type of poem for each letter. Like some would be just free prose. Another one was a limerick. Another was a ballad and a pontoon. And I use different forms, and because I always love to hear little kids struggle to pronounce words that are bigger than the words they know. We need these five men to protect our building. You know, so I was imagining with that book just how important it is for us to always kind of have our kids reaching out in front of themselves and not feeling like a cell phone or something is going to teach them, and keeping them always striving for adulthood than having the other way around, having adults striving for childhood.
I want to pull one other piece of music that you've recently released. This is Swing Symphony, Movement No. 1, St. Louis to New Orleans. In listening to that piece, for me, it really felt like you were capturing the soul of a place. Can music do that?
Yeah, music can do that in many ways. It can be a specific thing that you equate with a sound, but then when there are no people who know what that place is, it can be a place in the human soul that is also equally as specific.
Let's look forward in the genre. I want to play a bit of a New Age jazz artist. This is Crowned and Kissed by Esperanza Spalding.
Fire burns down, don't even make a sound. Don't worry about a thing, I'm here to love you. My kisses are your crown and I'm your queen, so now lay with me, my king. I'm here to love you.
What's your reaction to that?
I like her. It's like sounds like an R&B song to me.
And how would you make the distinction? How do you make the distinction across these genres that seem to bleed together?
What the bass and drums play most of the time.
Can you explain that more? This is me asking. I'm so curious.
Yeah, if the bass and drums are playing backbeat or groove-oriented music, punch, doodle-doom, chop, doodle-doom, doodle-doom, it's more like R&B. To me, that's not to say good or bad or to make a critique of her music at all. I'm critical of kind of larger cultural things, but I never critique a younger person's music. I'm merely describing what, to me, I listen to what bass and drums play, and they determine the style. Now, a musician can play a piece of jazz, a piece of R&B, R&B and jazz, or, you know, the pieces are all interchangeable, but most of the musicians, once they get to the kind of R&B grooves and the backbeat grooves, because that's what the public is most acclimated to hearing, they don't really go to anything swinging for too much.
Where do you think jazz is going next? What are you most excited about in
jazz?
I'm
excited about all the great young piano players that we have.
Any examples?
Like a young guy, Sean Mason, Joel Winhart, Miles Lennox, Joey Alexander, Isaiah Thompson, Micah Thomas, Robbie Lee. And whenever I hear them, I think, man, we have a lot of piano players out there that really can play and who are very, very serious. Those are the ones that I know and have heard, and I'm sure there are four or five other fantastic ones. And all of these, if you heard them play on a gig or something, they would blow your mind with the sophistication of their approach, the depth of their knowledge, their technical skills, their knowledge of jazz, and their willingness to play jazz.
How do you help get them introduced to the public? And maybe if you say the public's become most acclimated, for example, to the style of R&B, how do you bring them to these brilliant young piano players who have so much creativity to offer?
You know, it's very difficult. We do what we can at Jazz at Lincoln Center. We provide performances and we do different things. We put them on the stage, but it's difficult because they're in a hard critical environment. And also as younger people, who most of the people's tastes are formed by electronic music and backbeats and so on and so forth. That has become the definition of modern, and it tests their integrity. The arts will always put you in a challenging position. And it doesn't matter whether you're a younger musician today or if you're Haydn or Beethoven. They had questions of integrity that they had to face. Duke Ellington faced those questions, Louis Armstrong. Charlie Parker could have played like Louis Jordan, who did Ain't Nobody Here But Us Chickens. Charlie Parker made the choice to play in the style he played. It was not a popular style. So, you know, they too are faced with that choice. And I try to give them the strength to stretch their artistry and try to elevate the listening of their colleagues and not just follow their generation. However, I embrace them and love them regardless of the decisions they make. You know, I try to give them information and try to fortify them, but it's hard to accept not being popular or to not have a group that you want to like your music when you could just easily do something else that's less musically challenging but more socially satisfying.
With that in mind, for our young listeners who are aspiring musicians who may be hearing this, what piece of advice would you give them?
Stay in front of people. And don't feel like you have to play down to people. People will come with you. It takes longer, but also never forget about people when you're constructing your music, because if you could get so deep into your thing and it's so myopic and self-absorbed, I don't know. You don't make it so hard for me to follow you that I'm not gonna do that. Give me some way to follow you.
Jazz musician Wynton Marsalis, thank you so much for joining us here on Radio Boston.
Yes, ma'am. It's such a pleasure.
You can catch the Wynton Marsalis Quintet this Sunday, November 10th, at Boston Symphony Hall. You can find a link to tickets and more information on our website, radioboston.org. And that performance is presented by the Celebrity Series of Boston. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Jamie Bologna, and Walter Wolfman. Tim Skoog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.